Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
We are back for Season 3 and it's going to be a good one.
With the aim of raising the profile of British distance running, we're bringing you more content than ever.
Every week, we'll give you insights into the lives and training of some of the UK's top athletes and coaches,
as well as all the latest updates from the races up and down the country and around the world.
You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcast streaming platforms.
Keep a lookout for our new YouTube channel too, where we're posting workout videos, shoe reviews, and much more.
Stay up to date by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
And if you want to drop us a line, send us an email to info@sundaypodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the episode. Wow, what a guest for you all this week. Matt described him midweek as podcast royalty, and I think that sums it up pretty well. Two-time Olympic medalist and now Tracksmith community manager, Nick Willis, join us for this week's episode. Enjoy. Okay, Nick, first off, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on. And obviously, just want to shout out to Mass for organising things from Tracksmith's end. Look, we kind of chatted before. You're someone who needs no introduction at all within the world of distance running. But do you mind giving us an overview of what you're doing right now? Kind of how would you describe your current job situation and how you work with running and your family and work itself?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. Where am I at right now? It's probably the busiest time in my life. There was always this excitement that when I was finished running, I'd have this freedom to do all these other fun activities. But there's not a second of spare time in my day at the moment. It's like, this is the real world. So I'm in the thick of it right now. We've got a newborn. Our third son, Wesley, was born just under 6 months ago. So he's not getting any sleep, nor are mum and dad. Two other young boys who got all energy, 9 and 5, Lachlan and Darcy. So they got sports and school, and we homeschool as well. So managing all of their teaching element of it. And we just moved houses to accommodate the bigger family. So that's been sort of a big ordeal doing the move. And of course, sort of the anchor of my post-running career so far, the last 3 years, has been working at Tracksmith on a community team and getting involved in sort of a different side of the sport, which I wasn't always involved in. And it's been a real joy and delight both to learn and to sort of add my insights that I've picked up over the years in the sport of running and in the business world. And yeah, it's just been a real joy to be a part of a team and a company. Often as a runner, you're sort of doing things on your own the whole time. So that's been a real, another string to the bow, which I wasn't sure if I'd ever have the opportunity to experience. That's what I'm doing right now. My 9 to 5, my Monday to Friday. And on the weekends, it's going to watch my kids play basketball, basically.
It's interesting. How did the, you know, opportunity to, you know, work for Tracksmith and, like you said, have this career post running come about?
That basically came about because my contract with Adidas was coming up to an end, and I was considering renegotiating to try and get another term on that or looking with some other brands. But it was actually my wife's foresight, and she said, you know what, why don't you consider leveraging the last couple of years of your running career to potentially get your foot in the door with a company to start your post-running career, because we had both sort of wondered how and what that could look like. And I was always nervous whether anyone would accept me into the real world without anything on my resume for 17 years, you know. And so I reached out to someone who my wife and I had both coached as part of our online coaching business that we had, and as a guy named Matt Taylor, who happened to be the founder and CEO of Tracksmith. And we said, hey, Matt, you're a potential for like a hybrid sponsorship / working opportunity at your company. I'm not exactly sure how that would look. And he got back to me and said, well, we don't actually sponsor athletes, but we'd love to employ you as a full-time role. And I said, that would be even better. I'm ready to jump at that opportunity and learn. And that's really how it came to be. And it's funny to think now that this sort of seems normal for me being in the corporate world, because I could never even have imagined how I would sort of like get through the day. I always had these nightmares that I'd show up to my first ever job and just be sitting at the desk like, what am I supposed to do? No one's telling me what am I supposed to do, and like I don't belong here. But here I am now giving directions to other people, so that's fun as well.
Yeah. Wow, obviously we've had Matt himself on the podcast before, and I think he told some of that story as well. Look, obviously you just mentioned then that kind of in your career you almost couldn't see what was after running. So is it all right if we just rewind a bit and we'll come on to Tracksmith later, but we'll just go back and talk about your career itself. And obviously growing up in New Zealand, what was the running scene like there growing up, and when did you start thinking, oh, I want to do this as a career and be a professional runner?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of things, you think your little sphere of the world is the center of the universe, right? And my family was smack dab in the middle of the athletics and running scene. My dad was the announcer at the stadium, sort of like a smaller version of what Jeff and Jake Whiteman are doing, right? So he was the announcer at the national championships and all of these meets. So I was going along, and my older siblings were doing athletics. So I started being a part of that, doing shot put, high jump, long jump, relays, all of that stuff, in addition to running, since I was 4 years old. So that was always a part of my summer experience. But rugby was also the other sort of anchor sport in my family's and in my life all the way through high school also. So those were sort of the two sports that took up my world. And there was a lot of other kids out there. It was intense competition, but we're part of a club scene, much like in the UK, where there's a lot of mentors and the older generation in the masters running scene that sort of look down on the youth up and coming talents and sort of give us opportunities and help pitch in to help us get to events in different parts of the country and that sort of thing. And in New Zealand, we had had such a rich tradition in middle distance running, much like the UK, where you had had Coe and Ovid and Steve Cram, and everyone was waiting who was going to be the next sort of person to fill that role. New Zealand's wait had been even longer. Jack Lovelock, Peter Snell, John Walker had all been Olympic gold medalists and world record holders in the mile. And like, is there ever going to be another Kiwi to sort of get at the black singlet back on the international stage in that event? And as I started showing a little bit of talent as a junior, especially my final year of high school when I ran a 401 mile, suddenly my shoulder started getting tapped as like, this is sort of the next opportunity for a Kiwi to do something on the international stage. And so that sort of responsibility was put on my shoulders, but I was sort of eager and excited and willing to take on that role. And it gave me a little bit of, in my little pond, a little bit of fame, you know, and opportunities, a lot of doors open to travel the world and see what was out there. So I was willing and eager to explore those.
Mm. And then you developed, you know, you went through the American collegiate system, and that's where you met your lifelong coach, Ron Warhurst. Talk about that relationship a little bit.
Yeah, well, I actually tried to avoid going to America at first because a lot of the running fraternity in New Zealand had the sentiment, if you went to America, you'll get sort of used and abused, overraced, and scoring points for the university without sort of your long-term vision sort of prioritized. So I got invited to come over to the UK by a famous agent named Kim McDonald. He was the original sort of agent to bring over the Kenyan athletes to Teddington to train at Bushy Park on the west side of London. And I spent a month there and had the opportunity to maybe come and study at St. Mary's. They were going to start up a running institute there. And there was another young kid named Mo Farah who was 17 or so at the time. And we were going to be a part of this program. And then when I flew back to New Zealand to save up some money for that plan for the next year, Kim McDonald had a heart attack, unfortunately, and he passed away. And so that opportunity for me sort of went away with that situation. And I was sad for him, but also I was panicking, okay, what's the plan now? So I quickly got on an email and contacted Ron Warhurst, who had been like trying to recruit me to the University of Michigan. I said, Ron, is there still a spot available for me? And he said, yeah, when can you get on the plane? And so I went over to the States with sort of a little bit more leverage to say, this is what my hope and my dreams and my plans are. I'd already been sort of told from people from different countries what was possible. So I didn't need to just be at the the rule of the coach telling me I had to run three meets a week to score points for the university. And Ron said, no, I don't care about that. Like, we'd love for you to run for the university, but I want to help you become an Olympic champion. And that was sort of how the relationship started off. And he became a sort of another father figure to me once I had moved over to the other side of the world from New Zealand.
Wow, that's a fascinating story. And I didn't actually know how close you were to coming over to the UK either. So things could have been very different, I guess. But at the same time, it's interesting you mentioned how you'd heard so much about America being somewhere that burns out athletes. And obviously yourself, someone who's had so much longevity in your career, obviously four Olympics, 20 years of sub-4 miles. Is there any way you can describe into words how Ron Warhurst kind of and yourself managed to get that longevity in your career?
I think part of it was that I had the upbringing in New Zealand, and I'd read all of the books of all of the great runners in New Zealand, and there was sort of a rhyme and rhythm to how one trained, and it happened to be a formula which led to longevity as well. And that was really anchored on the one long run a week. It didn't have to be fast, but just sort of get out for these long runs over 2 hours and have a social experience with that, and an appreciation for just enjoying running for the simplicity of that element of it, and not always be so locked down on times and splits. And I think in the US, a lot of the time people think you have to train harder to be better always, or that applies to all fields of excellence. And so when I got there as a young freshman, an 18-year-old, I was like, I'm going to take a day off each week, guys. It doesn't matter what Ronnie says, I'm never going to run all 7 days. And then same for a lot of the long runs. He wanted me to only run 14 miles a week. And I said, no, I'm going to run 18 to 20, but I'm going to go a lot slower. And so I guess I had the fortune of having good enough credentials that he was willing to let me argue with him and not kick me off the team. Whereas some of the other kids didn't have that same, they always complained that if I was sick and I didn't show up to practice, that was unfair, because if they were sick and they didn't show up to practice, they'd be kicked off the team. But I had a little bit more freedom to make some of my own decisions around that. And Ron begrudgingly sort of accepted that I was quite stubborn of an athlete, but deep down he probably appreciated that he had someone that stood up to him at times as well. But especially later on in my career when I was married, him and my wife would just complain to each other about how stubborn and unwilling I was to listen to them. But I'd like to think that relationship of that it was a give and take. It wasn't just an authoritarian relationship. He was willing to make some concessions, and then I was able to feel empowered by that, and it allowed me to, when you have a say in what you do, then you're more willing to do it for a longer period of time, I think made a big difference.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And then, you know, from your collegiate career, you then transitioned into the pros and in 2008, getting your first Olympic medal. Talk about what it was like to transition from college to a pro back then.
Yeah, I mean, I was a pretty confident kid, as most kids who come out of the NCAA system are. You've had a lot of success, but then when you get onto the international circuit and you're racing against the very best in the world from Europe and from Africa and from Australia, it suddenly becomes, gosh, do I really belong here? And it really wasn't until I came around the corner with 100 meters to go that it suddenly dawned on me, wait a minute, I'm not only competing with these guys, I've got a shot at an Olympic medal here. And I found myself in third place with 50 meters to go. And I was like internally shaking my head, like, this can't be real. Like, I can't believe like that I would ever be in this position to have this opportunity. So that was probably the most incredible experience of my life, that sudden dawning of like, that this was actually potentially able to happen, and then the reality of it once I crossed that line. It changed the game as well. It suddenly meant that I now have to expect that, and there's more pressure. And like, when I don't do that, then I've underperformed. Whereas before that, I was always overperforming other people's sort of relatively low expectations of me. So that brought on other pressures and expectations. And then I had a number of injuries after that required surgery. And then you're worried about how your sponsors, the people that write you checks, are feeling about you not sort of delivering on what their hopes and dreams for their investment would be. So yeah, the professional world was amazing, but it also came with a lot of other sort of realities to it that aren't always as rosy as you hope, but I wouldn't change that experience for the world either.
Mm-hmm. And just on the longevity again, like I know we kind of mentioned how long you had as a pro, but I think what's maybe more surprising and more impressive is you managed to do it in the 1500 consistently and the mile, rather than we might see some people, maybe they go to the 1500 in 08 and then by 2020 or 2016 they're running the 5k or the 10k. How do you think you managed to stay in the same event, and not just that, but obviously 2016 meddling in the 1500 again?
Yeah, I mean, I kept asking myself that, what was the reasoning? But I think it ultimately came down to the traditional Arthur Lydiard way of training, that the long run is the anchor of your fitness, and that I didn't feel like I needed to rely on getting on the track, putting on spikes and smashing out these leg ball busting workouts that just leave you hating life for a moment, you know. But when it adds up year after year, you do end up saying, do I really want to put myself through the rigors of that again? But even the 60-year-old guy running London Marathon in April, who's going to knock out some 20 milers in the next couple of months, like, he has a smile on his face. There's a real satisfaction when we do those. They're tiring, don't get me wrong, but they don't just like really just knock you out and wonder whether you're really willing to go back and do that again. And so I think that ultimately is the reason, is that I relied my fitness on the long run, and then I kept my speed going by doing short sprints as opposed to that stuff that just has you standing over the trash bin after a workout, you know.
Do you think at any point you kind of shaped Ron Warhurst's, you know, training beliefs and philosophies? Did you change, you know, almost what he was doing? You had an impact on him?
Yeah, and that's a real testament to Ron, is that he's been doing this for a long, long time. And some of the stuff is the same for the last 40 years. He's had many other great runners as well. And I think we've all both had a vocal influence on the training that he should do. Like, he's willing to do what we want, because he knows it's important to keep us psychologically confident, but also he's learned how we've responded and made adjustments. And so what he does now today with the next group of athletes he has is different than what he did with me when I was a first with him. But each new crop of athlete that comes through, he's still adapting. And they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but Ronnie's 80 years old and he is still learning new tricks. So that shows a lot of humility on his behalf as well, that he's not just going to stick to his guns. And coaches can have egos and are very, very stubborn a lot of the time as well. So
just before we move on from Ron Warhurst, one thing we've got to ask, the Michigan workout itself, is there any sort of stories you've got behind that, or anything you're willing to share, maybe some scarily fast split times or anything like that, or is it just the workout itself?
No, I've grown a deeper and deeper appreciation for that workout as I've gotten older, because I've learned that it can be approached in so many different ways depending on what you're trying to get out of it. And it's really up to the athlete how they want to approach the workout. Like, if I'm getting ready for a cross country race, I'll push the tempo run portions a lot more and just sort of like stay in control on the track. But if it's track season, I'll really back off the tempo portions and just really smash the 800 and the 400, or at a time in between those seasons, I'll sort of do a hybrid of those two different options. Right. It's really fascinating to see newbies come into the Michigan when we have new athletes come in each year. And very, very rarely does someone complete their first Michigan. Something happens, and it's normally that their mind just breaks down, because you get through the first half of the workout and you think, there's no way that I can manage that, because you think you have completed half of the reps and so you got another half to go. But the truth is, because the distances of each rep become less distance, you're actually far more than halfway through the workout, but your mind can't wrap itself around that element. And also the fact that tempo running is a completely different energy system than when you're on the track, when you're doing anaerobic work. So the tempo runs, although they're tiring, you're actually able to recover your anaerobic system during that process. So you have to see that as like, although it's extremely difficult, it's actually helping your body recharge for the next element. So you've got to like trick your mind. So it helps you work through all the different physical and emotional elements of running.
Yeah, I mean, we are interested. Can you remember your best Michigan? Or has anyone gone quicker than you on a Michigan?
Yeah, guys, now that they've put the super shoes on, I've smashed my times. But I think pretty close before I ran my 1500 meter PR, I think it was maybe 3 weeks before I ran a 3:29. I think I was 4:16 for the mile, 3:10 for the 1200, 1:58 for the 800, and 51 for the 400. Wow. So there are guys who run like 4:12 and 3:07, maybe not the 51 for the last 400 though. But yeah, that's the thing. Like you train, but then you also have to race, and your body is different. When training is when you're hitting your full volume in a training week, right? The volume that I run in a normal training week is like 80, 85 miles a week when I was at my peak. But when I'm racing, it's like 30 miles a week. And so some people have a lot more energy in their legs when they come off and they taper like that. And I was one of those responders. So I was able to race at a whole different level than I trained at. But a lot of other people, if they drop down their mileage that much, it doesn't necessarily help them bump up their performance that much more. So what your times you hit in training doesn't necessarily correlate to race performance relative to others.
Yeah, look, you mentioned how you kind of got in touch with Tracksmith in the first place and Matt Taylor. Obviously, for the last, what, two or 3 years, you're actually running for Tracksmith but also working. Talk us about that period of your life where you sort of knew retirement was around the corner, but you're also still trying to compete at a very high level at the same time.
No, it's a very fond period of my career, because I had the flexibility and freedom and the permission from my bosses to like schedule off key workouts on my work week. That was part of work because I was also representing the brand on the track. And so work never got in the way of getting the hard work done that I needed to. But it just meant once the workout was over, I couldn't go and have brunch. I had to get back onto my laptop and get ready for more meetings, right? But I was at a stage of life where I was really interested in that. I'd been around the block 15 years, I think, as a pro runner, and it became a little redundant. So I was looking forward to something new, and it really gave me a refreshed perspective on the sport, especially that I was involved initially. My primary focus was working with our amateur support program, which is our umbrella program supporting the athletes that are sort of caught between the college support structure and the professional structure. So they're really good runners, but they're not pro runners. So it gave me a much healthier perspective of what they're having to go through every day. And I was one of them as well, right? I was working full time as well. You can sort of get down on yourself and think that it's sort of first world problems when you're a pro runner. You think things are really tough, but all you're really doing is stretching and eating and sleeping all the time. It's a pretty cruisy life, to be honest.
Yeah. Do you think like earlier in your career, if you'd had that kind of work as well, to what level do you think you could have got to doing that as well?
I think if it was for 10 months of the year, it wouldn't have had any impact on my performance in the summer. Because the truth is, my wife and I were always entrepreneurial. We always had other little side hustles, or maybe not hustles, but like voluntary work, or we did a lot of public speaking and traveling around New Zealand doing a lot of work in those areas. But I think the number one sort of thing for me, part of what made me able to do what I did in the sport, is I was able to have a singular focus and really hone in for a period of time and put the blinders on, so to speak. And I would have had a really hard time to really like get into that zone where I was just, nothing was going to distract me from the task at hand if I was also having to multitask. I think it's healthier to multitask for 10 months of the year, but there's that sort of 2 month period before the big races that you really need to like get into that zone that I probably wouldn't have been able to get to that quite that same level.
Yeah, I mean, just on that 2 month period, it's been discussed quite a lot recently. I think Jakob came out in an interview and said there's probably the hardest part of the sport is that 2 month period. Is there anything, you spoke about that taper, that going from 80 to 30 mile a week. Is there anything you've done in particular to kind of really reach that pinnacle, you know, peaking for the Olympic Games and, you know, those quick times?
I mean, I really loved that period of time because your body feels incredible because you're coming off the volume a little bit and you've got this extra time and focus to just concentrate on stretching. I would like going on training camps during that period of time, primarily to get away from my house so I didn't have chores to do. I didn't have to mow the lawns or fix the roof or all of that sort of like other normal mundane stuff, which is healthy to have in the other 10 months of the year. So going up to training camps where you would just sort of have a singular focus. My wife and I sort of based all of our travel experiences around food, because you can't really spend 3, 4, or 5 hours in the Louvre when you're getting ready for a race, right? But if there's the best crepes in Paris, we're like, all right, let's go like get an Uber and go to like this little boutique crepe place on the other side of Paris this evening, like stuff to look forward to. That would sort of be the day would be based around training, sleeping, recovering, and then going to this one place. And that those are the memories we have of all of the incredible traveling experiences we had over these years. I mean, I raced in every continent on the earth other than Antarctica, and I think hit like 50 something countries over the time. So it's a pretty incredible experience. And to see that as like an energy builder as opposed to a sapper. And when you're tapering, you're also doing your final preparation races in these different countries. So I incorporated that element into it. And one of those things was finding massage therapists in each of these different countries. And that was always a fascinating experience because you're spending a lot of intimate time, 90 minutes on a table with the guy from Italy or from Greece or from Brazil or whatever. You learn a lot about their culture and their country. It's how I learned to speak Italian a little bit, because he became my Italian language specialist when all of those times on the table when we were based in Italy. So that's what I remember most about that taper period.
Wow. Did that area of your life get harder once you had your first child and you were still competing at the highest level?
First child, no, that was easy. Like, it was actually a healthy distraction for us, and he didn't know any better. He was just doing whatever we were doing. And kids need to sleep a lot, so we sleep whenever he slept, right? I think kids need to sleep something like 16 hours a day. So I was getting tons of sleep. But yeah, once we had our second, that became a lot more challenging. And then once we had our third, it's become basically next to impossible. I hoped to keep running at a decent rate this past year, but I literally haven't been running at all for the last 6 months, like maybe once or twice a week, just because it's become a lot more difficult with all of the other commitments, which need to take a greater priority than my sport.
Let's chat about that ASP program that you work on then, because that's recently opened in the UK, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's been real fun to sort of focus our resources on those who have sort of almost the forgotten athletes once they become sort of they leave the college system. In America, at least, the college system is such an incredible support structure. You've got your teammates, you've got your facilities, you've got all the medical support. You travel on buses and in team uniforms to all of these meets. You don't really have to do any thinking. You just train and race and everything's taken care of for you. But then once you graduate, suddenly you're on your own. It's like, okay, what do I do now? It's like the Wild West. People are just got to sort of figure out things as they go, and then they get on the start line and they're on their own and it's a random singlet, while their competitors might be part of some of these formal professional groups from Nike, Adidas, Brooks or Saucony or what have you. So it's been really nice to sort of come alongside these athletes and share my experiences, having been in this world for so many years, and say, look, we may not be able to provide you with the same level of support these professional groups are getting, but we can help you feel like you're a part of a team. You've got a brand that knows your name and has got your back and will cheer you along throughout the season and find ways to find little ways to give you that level of support, whether it be having a massage therapist at certain events, have some travel and accommodation provided for if there's a need for that. And just a way to make athletes feel like they're not alone in this journey, but they're actually part of something bigger than themselves. And it sort of takes that the battle that a lot of these athletes are facing is like, should I really still be doing this, or should I be getting on with my life and forgetting about this hobby that I have? Because that's the question the aunties and uncles and everyone's asking him now, you know. So by being a part of this program, it almost validates their decision to still be pursuing this. And so now bringing it to the UK, it's a slightly different dynamic because the collegiate system isn't necessarily the same way. But there's still many of the same issues as athletes who are part of the club structures. That's great, but sometimes they get beyond the level that there aren't the training partners or the sense of belonging, because they can't just show up on the Tuesday and Thursday night workouts, right? Because they need to actually train at 3 in the afternoon, not at nighttime after everyone's working and that sort of thing. So we want to help bring the UK athletes together. There might be 20 or 30 of them spread around the country. But one of the cool opportunities with the UK is it's geographically closer. So we can potentially bring people together for a few training camps, long weekend sort of thing in the future. And hopefully I'll be able to bring them together to hopefully get to some races together so we can have some medical support at these races as well. So it's not a huge level of support, but it's something to make them feel like, all right, I'm not on my own in this journey. And hopefully we'll help them make the next jump. And if they're able to get a full pro contract and graduate out of our program, we consider that the ultimate success and that we've sort of played our part, and we're very content and happy if they're able to get another brand to give them a more lucrative opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant way of doing things, and there's definitely a need for it. Do you find yourself personally mentoring any of these athletes? Do you get to talk to them on more of a personal level?
Yeah, especially in the first year when this was pretty much the only focus of my role with the Tracksmith. So I had a lot more time and bandwidth to sort of focus on that. And we didn't have as many athletes as well. So that was a key element of it. And so I've built a rapport with especially those who have, it's like anything, right? The more they put in, the more they get out of it. So those who reached out to me, I was able to develop a relationship with. But as I've become more senior in the company, I've taken on more responsibilities in the brand. It's more sort of an overview of the program and supporting it. And the hope is that we can bring in other experts, that we've got a sports psychology session next week sort of thing. And we'll bring in other people that can help fill that role as well. But at the US Championships, that's an opportunity for us to bring the athletes into our hospitality suite throughout the week to get away from the hotel rooms. And then in the UK, we're still trying to figure out what's the UK equivalent of that. So that's the feedback that we're trying to seek from those athletes at the moment, is it's sort of in its infancy. We've only had them in the program for a week at this stage.
Yeah, I have seen a few British people have been rocking the Tracksmith singlet even out in Valencia on the weekend. So you're clearly doing something. But I was just going to say, you know, you guys are filling that gap in the market. Did you have any frustrations with the sport, you know, through your career? The way it's run, the way competitions are run, the way it's presented, marketed?
Yeah, I mean, we always have frustrations, right? And I think now that I'm out of the sport as a competitor, I realized so many of my frustrations were almost very selfishly focused. It was always the men's 1500 meters, how that event was affected. I didn't really care about anything else in the sport because that's what I was in, right? And I deemed that to be the most important event. So taking a step outside has given me an opportunity to have a little bit more humility and try and think of it with a little bit more of an objective perspective. But I was sort of frustrated at the time when they got rid of the Golden League and they turned it into the Diamond League. But all they did really was they combined the Super Grand Prix with the Golden League and they called it All Diamond League. But all they did was they took away the most grand element of the sport, and they lessened it down, and they basically watered it down. So we don't have any level of the sport which is at the same level of like tennis or golf, whereas the Golden League in the past, there was a $1 million jackpot if you won. There was actually like a legitimate opportunity for the superstars to make something grand. Now I think to win a Diamond League, you might win $12,000 or $10,000, whereas that used to be the third or fourth place prize at a Golden League. So yeah, I think the sport tries to appeal to appease all of the different interest groups, and then by doing so you end up not taking care of any of them in many ways. So I've always thought that except for the most grand levels of the sport, the Olympic Games, the World Championships, and perhaps some of these really high level Grand Prix events, we might be better off sort of segmenting our sport into the more sort of like natural interest groups. You got the sprint crowd, the distance crowd, and the field events crowd. Maybe have some more like focused events. The Night of Tens is like the ultimate example, right? In the UK, that's become an incredible party atmosphere, and it's because all the people that attend that event care about the 10,000 meters. If a shot put fan or a sprint fan went to that event, they'd probably find it boring. So why like subject the crowd to spectacles that they're not interested in? Only like give what the crowd wants. And so if we segmented it out a little bit more, we could have the equivalence of the Night of Tens for the shot put or for the hammer throw or for the 100 meters. Imagine bringing like grandstands down to either side of the straightaway for a sprints only meet, and it was just this 8-lane narrow strip with crowds coming up either side. It looked like a drag race and like car racing, you know. That rather than having the fans having to watch from the back straight, which is a good 80 meters away from lane one, you could have like the crowd fully like creating a cauldron just for a sprints only meet. I think that'd be far more of a spectacle.
You paced a miles meet last year, was it, in London?
Yeah, we put on the inaugural amateur mile at the Olympic Stadium warm-up track. I think it has a different name, the community track, London community track, is it called? But yeah, that was a lot of fun. We did that on a weeknight, I believe, and we had over 250 people came. And the hope of a lot of the events we put on at Tracksmith is to bring people from sort of the road running world, the fun runs and the major marathons, that sort of thing, and get them to experience what those who have been on the inside of the sport all these years, that experience of running on the track under lights with a pacemaker. It's the ultimate way to run a PR. You're not stuck on the start line in a road race for 40 minutes in the cold before the gun comes off. You actually get to do a proper warm up and strides and all of that process to have your body operated at its very best. So that's what we did in London in May last year. I think we're going to push it back to June this year to try and get slightly more favorable weather conditions. And we might move it to a Saturday as the hope, so that we can extend the day into a longer period, so it's not getting too late at night, and so we can have up to 500 people coming. That would be the hope. So we're really excited to bring that event back to London and also do it in a few cities in the US as well.
That's terrific. I think a lot of people will be looking out for it. Do you is it weird going back to London 2012 after, you know, competing there? Have you been back to any other Olympic stadiums in your career?
Unfortunately, I deem London like my major failure of my career. Because I was a favorite to win a medal, and in the last 200 meters, my feet felt like they're in quicksand, and I had the best view of the house to watch people running away from me. And so I remembered leaving the stadium and trying to find my family. And there were like 40 or 50 family and friends who had come over from New Zealand, America, and Australia to come and watch me. And they had rented out a restaurant in the Westfield shopping center next to the stadium to have like an after party, assuming that I'd won a medal, right? And it was a pretty somber experience when I finally walked in there after drug testing, and everyone's like, oh, good job. But it was a really like let down experience. So when I went back for the amateur mile, I was one of the organizers of this event, and I had to go pick up some supplies from Westfield. I walked past that restaurant. I just got the most sickening feeling in my stomach as I walked past that place. But also quite comical thinking about how a memory like that can suddenly trigger your emotions that way.
Yeah. Wow. Do you have any like fonder memories now, having like gone back and done that? Can you kind of look back at all on it being a positive experience or still not at all?
Well, I was the flag bearer at the London Olympics. So that was a really cool experience. I have fond memories of that. And I got to meet Queen Elizabeth in the Olympic Village and had the photo taken, shaking her hand, that got spread around the world. So that's always cool to be able to show my kids, you know. But I used London as a training base for many, many years in Teddington. So, yeah, I have very fond memories every time I go back to go for a run around Bushy Park or Richmond Park. And I think what I enjoy most about touching down at Heathrow and then going for my first run, wherever it is, it's just seeing cricket fields again, living in the States where that doesn't exist. Like, it gives me a sense of coming home, even though the UK and New Zealand are complete opposite sides of the world. I think the weather and the way that the grass grows is like unique to those two different climates. It's really strange, and it's the time that I feel the closest to being back in New Zealand, other than when I am in New Zealand, is when I run around the cricket fields at one of these parks in the UK.
I was going to say, do you have a favorite location to train throughout your career?
My favorite place in the world is a place called Wanaka, which is in the Queenstown Lakes area in New Zealand. But yeah, Bushy Park's always been a fond memory for me as well. But yeah, I'd say Wanaka is probably the ultimate training location, closely followed by Flagstaff, Arizona.
Yeah, wow.
One thing I want to know is, obviously, throughout your career as a professional, you've got to have like so many goals. It's so high pressure, so high performance. How do you replace that in your work life, or do you need to?
I think I'm still trying to learn that, but what I'm discovering that I get depressed if I'm not working towards a goal. And so I've had moments where it's been hard the last couple of years. It's not so much in work, but it's just in just my time at home. I feel like I'm most alive when I'm working towards something, and it doesn't matter what that is. And this is prior to me being an elite runner. Like, I only became a good runner once I was a senior in high school. Prior to that, it was one of the many things I was trying to see if I could do something with. And so the golf course sort of really caught my interest as an intermediate school, sort of 12 years old through to 16, because like aiming to improve your handicap, it became this addicting feeling trying to improve every week. And so that filled that void at the time. And then running became that for me, as I was trying to improve my running times. But once I was no longer able to improve my PRs on the track, I had to find something else. And so skateboarding was a way to sort of return to something I did in the youth, but also try and improve that. But honestly, I've just become so busy that those sort of physical outlets haven't been an option for me the last 6 months. But now that I'm really focused on my job, and now I've been given opportunities to manage other people, that's become a real interest to see how I can improve as more of a people person and someone on that side of things. Listening wasn't a great skill set of mine when I was an athlete. I was sort of very stubborn non-listener. So obviously I've had to really work on that area. So that's where I'm trying to improve the most.
You know, on that kind of selfish mindset, do you think athletes who reach the level you did, they do need an element of that in their lifestyle?
Yeah, I think people assume that we always need to be competitive. I don't think I have any competitive nature left in me. And I didn't really for the last 2 years of my career either. And I always thought it was my competitiveness that made me get to the level I did in my sport, but it wasn't. It was that I had a desire to improve and to pursue goals relative to myself. And so that itch can still be scratched in all other facets of life if you have a chance to like focus on those things. But when you're a dad of three kids and you got other responsibilities, you got to learn to not always just focus on your own stuff. Like, helping your kids out is really the focus. Mm-hmm. Try and be a better dad and a husband. Those are really hard things to do, and that's other areas that I need to improve and I'm working on as well.
Yeah, you said that. Are they all playing basketball then? You said not running at all.
No, my 9-year-old likes to play basketball, yeah.
What about any interest in running yet?
He says that he hates running, but I don't know what he thinks. Like I've always felt like I wouldn't want a kid to run until they get to high school anyway. I'd rather have them do other sports. Whether that's because I actually truly believe that, or it's because I worry that he would feel like pressure to try and live up to the Willis name or anything like that, but he can figure out, my kids can figure out what they're interested in. There's a lot of fun things to do in this world. You don't want to be stuck having to have your parents choose what you should do for you.
Yeah, for sure. Look, Nick, just before we finish up then, what's next for you? Do you have sort of like, obviously, yeah, just described kind of being a father and stuff like that. Obviously, there's plenty more of that to come, but anything else on your radar, like next 5, 10 years or so?
I mean, I've gotten crazy out of shape the last 6 months. I put on 20 pounds. I can barely run a sub 18 minute 5K right now. And I that needs to change. Like if I keep down this trajectory, you won't recognize me in another year. And that can't happen. So once my 6 month old starts getting his sleep patterns down and I can sneak out for some early morning runs again, I'd like to get back into some reasonable shape and maybe get just make running a more of a lifestyle as opposed to a thing that's just about performance. But yeah, I would like to become someone who has more involvement in the company, helping grow our sport in unique and inventive ways, and hopefully bringing along the next crop of young people into the company that need to be mentored. I've benefited from other great mentors, and I'd like to be someone that is doing that for them as well.
I mean, talking of that, just a little word on like Hobbs Kessler. I know you were very kind of close with him, especially that year he kind of took off in 334. Are you still in touch with the group in Michigan?
Yeah, I talk to Hobbs's dad every day. He's a good friend, and Hobbs calls me once every couple of weeks to say what's my thoughts on what Ronnie is giving him for training. I said, look, my relationship is way with Ronnie is way more important than how you're running. So just listen to whatever he says. That's not what I would have done as an athlete, though. I would for the whole time. But no, it's fun being around those guys, and that's part of my motivation to get back into some shape. I've got a little bit of FOMO watching them work out. It looks like a fun time getting on that train and doing knocking out some fast 200 and 300. So I'd like to be able to hang out with those guys on the track again and not just be on the sidelines.
Yeah. Wow. Look, Nick, it's been awesome to chat to you. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it.